The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices. Conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us in the studio today, in his full pink-shirted splendor, is UD Professor Yasser Payne from the Black American Studies Department. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Definitely a privilege and an honor to be here.
All right. Before we get going, talk to me about that pink shirt.
Yes. So I want everyone to know, right? So it's in some minds, you know, a bit of a taboo to for men to wear pink shirts. Although that idea, I think, is rapidly changing. Keep this in mind, right? Keep in mind, I'm a hip hop scholar. In addition to being a street ethnographer, I do teach a hip hop class. But one of the things I featured or I focused on in class is how Cam'ron, who's a very popular rap artist, he also is, you know, the head of or the lead of a hip-hop collective called Diplomats or Dipset for short. But in any event, right, he does have this gangster rap persona. And what he decided to do, maybe about 10 years ago, is make pink fashionable but for men and definitely guys who are caught up in the criminal justice system. And his influence has been so a magnetic, if you will, that literally it's influenced clothing lines, fashion lines, across the board. So yes, it's not that uncommon to see, you know, white men who are brokers on Wall Street wearing pink suits and or pink shirts, right, or pink sweaters. And all of it was influenced by a gangster rapper. So I'm originally from Harlem. You should know that. Also raised in North New Jersey, too. So.
Now, since you've been here, you've been doing a lot of really interesting things. You've already talked about the hip-hop class you teach, which I'm sure is very popular with the undergraduates. But one of the things that you're getting really well known for is your participatory action research in the city of Wilmington.
Yes, sir.
How is that different from what I'm used to, like the scientific method, the man in the white coat, totally out of it, just being an objective observer?
Yeah, I think part, right, keep in mind, it's a methodological framework, not a single method. But it can house most theoretical and empirical and methodological projects, right, underneath this thing called PAR. PAR, really quickly, or participatory action research, the term is first coined by the famous social psychologist Dr. Kurt Lewin in 1946 in an article that he writes in the Journal of Social Issues, which is still a pretty prominent article in the field mm-hmm. of psychology. What it requires is it requires professors to include on the research team members of the population being studied. And while that may not appear to be very provocative or controversial for the everyday person, for those of us who are inside the academy, the idea we would include everyday people on our research teams, in many respects, violates our traditions, right? So I'm a street ethnographer. I have a PhD in social psychology. That means I spend a lot of time around folk who are caught up in the criminal justice system. And if I do PAR with them, then that means I need folk who were involved with the criminal justice system to be on my research team, right? And you work with them and you train those PAR members just like doctoral students. That becomes at least one way of giving back and equipping that population with a skill set so that they can continue the transition into upward mobility, right? And in addition to PAR being a research experience, it is also an action experience or an activism experience. So in addition to collecting data and organizing and executing some sophisticated analysis, right, we must complement the analysis and or the publications with action, with social justice, right, with shaking it up, if you will, on the ground, which becomes in and of itself a way to communicate the message, right, of PAR, particularly to everyday people on the ground. Just really quickly, I think PAR values and underscores the voice of people that are generally ignored and dismissed by people in positions of authority, right? So folk in the communities, in my case, guys that are, and women that are caught up in the streets and criminal justice system are my subject matter experts, right? They now get mm-hmm. to be in the lead and frame the project and the research questions and really have say or input with regard to the organization of of the methodological design and or the data analysis, right? They have a real role in how data is organized. We should know much of our society is organized and or much of the our values, our policies, our laws, the legislation that's introduced. A lot of it, right, undergirding all of that is research, right? And keep in mind, so given that the criminal justice system and its policies are a big issue in today's society, it's more important now than ever that folk from these communities who are mostly affected by the criminal justice system be involved with regard to the research projects and or data, right, that's being generated, so that they have an opportunity to impact and inform the policy and or the legislation and laws that would eventually result. So that's the thinking around PAR.
Almost a form of intervention where you're then passing skills on to some of the people who would ordinarily just be participants.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Right. So this becomes right a way. So part. So the action happens on two levels. Definitely action and activism to local communities. And we can talk a little bit about what we've done, in the communities. But it's also action to PAR members. Right. So this two level notion of intervention and or action or activism, right? So keep in mind, one of the things that are blocking young men and women, right, from doing better, particularly young men and women from low-income black and brown neighborhoods and or those caught up in the criminal justice system, one of the barriers is the skill set, right? They need the professional capital to be able to transition, to be able to compete, to be able to be competitive outside of their neighborhoods. Right. So what are we teaching them? Well, we're teaching them theory. We're teaching them quantitative and qualitative analysis. We're teaching them how to publish in these science journals. We're also equipping them with a speaking or public speaking skill set. Right. So I'm saying, hey, why don't you come along with me so that we can present at different universities our project, our data. Right. There's a sense of ownership with regard to the data. So PAR on many different levels, right, directly impacts communities and individuals. But we do take the piece seriously with regard to arming and equipping our street PAR members with a reading, writing, data analysis, and activist-centered skill set. Because at some point, the project will end, right? And they will have to be able to fend for themselves. But we do have to give them the tools and the skills so that they can more appropriately fend for themselves.
What parts of Wilmington are you working in now? And what are some of the conclusions that you and your team are starting to come up with?
Great question. So the name of our project is entitled The People's Report. You can learn more about our project at thepeoplesreport.com. A very interactive website. We have a 176-page report. We have trailers. We have a YouTube page. We have social media, Facebook and Twitter and Google Plus. We have a documentary that also highlights what we've done. But more specifically, what did we find? So keep in mind, People's Report, we were charged with the task of examining violence, notions of physical violence in the East Side and Southridge neighborhoods of Wilmington, Delaware. You know, we had a robust institutional partnership of four nonprofit organizations, three universities. We went into the community and were able to recruit 15 PAR members. 15 street PAR members, 12 men, 3 women between the ages of 20 to 48, for the most part involved in just about any crime that you can imagine, with the exception of sexual assault. We did screen those applicants out. Most folk on the PAR team were about 1 year out of prison, right? So 12 men, 3 women, and we decided to go into the streets of the East Side and Southbridge neighborhoods, right? We went to hot sites, we went to cool sites, we went to warm sites. Another way of thinking about this is we went to where they sold drugs at. We went to where, you know, some dicey behavior sometimes takes place to collect data, right? So we collected 520 surveys from the street corners of Wilmington. We also interviewed about approximately 50 individuals between the ages of 18 to 35.
Wow.
Right? And we're very interested in understanding the question of to what extent does opportunity or the lack thereof predict experiences with violence. So some take-home messages. What did we find from our research? We found that most people in the streets of Wilmington, definitely in our study, are not violent as a form of identity. There is not a wild, wild west scenario going on in Wilmington, Delaware. If that was the case, the National Guard would descend immediately. Right. So keep in mind, there are only about 14,000-15,000 homicides per year. Right. Another individual killing another individual.
Nationally.
Nationally. right? That is about a fraction of a percent of the total population. More, you are more likely to die as a function of other factors, right? So alcohol-related deaths or, you know, disease and so forth and so on. So I'm not trying to minimize the 14,000 to 15,000 homicides by any stretch of the imagination. What I am trying to say is sometimes media, or oftentimes media, exaggerates what's going on in the communities. But with that said, we do have a problem. The violence, we do know, even though it's coming down nationally, the violence is moving to medium and small cities. So the violence is ticking up there, right? And Wilmington, Delaware is an example of that as a small city. But what did we find in terms of our work? Well, A, we found that economic well-being was predictive of the violence. So that is, economic well-being declined in the sample. Experiences with violence
increased.
Right, increased. Mm-hmm. We also found that about nearly 70% of the men in our study were unemployed. Right. So when we look at,
wait, that's not 17. That's 70. 70.
Right. And keep in mind, on average, 50 to 70% of low-income black men and or black men in low-income communities, right? 50 to 70% of these men are unemployed across the country, right? That's routine. That's routine. So when we look at the Great Recession, when we had a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% unemployment rate, we were about to pull our hair out as a society. Okay, that is laughable to these neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
They, right? So that 50 to 70% percent unemployment rate for black men, women are generally not that far behind, right? In our study, we found that 62% of the women were unemployed, right? Keep in mind, right, these levels of unemployment is par for the course. These experiences with unemployment is something that they experienced before, during, and after the Great Recession. This is life in these communities, right? And for us to kind of think about reducing violence without ever having to resource these communities, I often say to civic and political leadership, that's a failed plan, right? All right, so we also found that 100% of all black boys in the Southbridge neighborhoods, right, one of the two neighborhoods we did study mm-hmm. out of, were dropping out of high school. Years on end, nobody losing any sleep, and that's including black people, I might add, right? And, you know, so I'm scratching my head and I'm saying, how come, you know, and so I had to bring in the board of directors and we had to get the media to do a story. And first, no one believed us. I get it, right? Because it's pretty unbelievable, right? but we were saying, hey, based on all the evidence that we have before us, we need some attention around this. Keep in mind, no one population ever does any one thing. That's stat 101, human development 101, meaning what? You have inherent variation. The idea that black boys, right, that every last single one of them would be dropping out of high school years on end, right? That for us, meaning social scientists, that strongly suggests that the problem is structural. So I have met with the governor and his policy team, and also had the fortunate opportunity to meet with Mark Murphy before he resigned, Secretary of Education, to talk about all of these things, right? We know, meaning the literature, meaning the national trend, right? Dropout rates are mostly explained by the schools themselves. The idea that some young man is sitting at home smoking a marijuana cigarette and listening to Lil Wayne and saying, I don't want to go to school, is tugging at the worst parts of our imaginations about black boys. And again, black people suffer from these stereotypes, right? And think that black children, particularly in poor neighborhoods, don't want to go to school. That's why it makes it so easy, right, to kick them out of school. So what's going on, more accurately, right, is that you have school officials, you have school teachers, you have other school officials that are innovatively and creatively removing the children, who in all fairness typically are academic and disciplinary in problems, but they're not dropping out. Right. And it's also illegal and unconstitutional to handle the problem in that way. And then once you remove them because, you know, they don't know the educational rights to fight back. Right. You then, meaning the schools, count them as a dropout. So I've also spoken with superintendents and principals and school teachers about this in Delaware. And, you know, these are all off the record conversations. So no names will be mentioned. But no one's denying that this is going on. Right? I haven't had one person, you know, meaning in the school system or among civic and political leadership, that says you're wrong. In fact, off the record, let's go behind closed doors and really tell you what's going on. And that is, I mean, the implications of this, right? The destabilization of, of black generations for generations on end, right? The implications of this, and this is just par for the course. So not to get too impassioned, but these are the kinds of findings or results that came from the People's Report.
Sounds to me like some of the action and participatory action research is the action you take with your findings.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, so we've been, you know, we're been writing vigorously, just a bunch of journal articles, book chapters. We've given well over 100 presentations of this project alone, which is a testament to the interest in it, right? Love the people of Wilmington. They've embraced me and or the project. The PAR team, the PAR family, excuse me, Wilmington Street PAR family is how we identify. You know, so it's been, you know, in many respects, a strong relationship, you know, inclusive of mutual support. So, but definitely the action, our action has evolved in many ways. So definitely the speaking is one form of action. One thing we've been doing, though, is taking the arts really, really seriously.
Cool.
As a way to be loud, right? Keep that in mind. So it becomes a nice way to be loud. So we've launched two street art exhibitions. The last one we launched at DCCA, or the Delaware Center for Contemporary Arts. 50 artists, right, from low-income black and brown neighborhoods, mostly untrained, produced 276 pieces of art, right, for this high-end art center on the riverfront, right? And they were featured in the biggest gallery, right? Keep in mind, the place can only fit about 500 or 600 people. Our opening night, we probably had well over 1,000 people in there. We almost considered closing it because of was a fire hazard, but the art was centered on the theme of inequality, right, and crime. So you had oil painting, sneaker art, we had graffiti, we had photography, right, all art depicting the structural violence, right, that is undergirding the lived experiences of poor people of color in Wilmington.
One of the things I think is remarkable, you hear Yasser Payne talking with passion about all the problems in these neighborhoods in Wilmington. But one of the things you found was a positive, a resilience in the communities.
Yes. We define resilience a little bit differently, though, right? So resilience is generally seen as a positive thing. We actually understand it more so as a neutral construct. Or meaning what? Meaning, so we also are arguing that the crack cocaine dealers are resilient, too, right? That they want to see their communities improved, that they are contributing, ironically enough, to the improvement of their community. Right. So we found that our sample actually has high levels of psychological and social well-being. Right. And keep in mind, these are the crack cocaine dealers. Most would argue, including the black community, that folk who engage in armed robbery or sell drugs or whatever, right, illegal activities are self-hating people who have low self-esteem and feel hopeless. OK, the community says we don't feel hopeless. We do feel powerless to change the structural conditions, though. Right. But we don't hate ourselves. We tested it. Right. Meaning, you know, we have 500. We asked about it in interviews, and we have lots of survey data on esteem, and their esteem is out the roof. I mean, it is incredible. And in fact, we argue that their high levels of psychological and social well-being is contributing to maybe offsetting, controlling, and containing the violence. In fact, if their psychological and social well-being scores were not as high as they are, more than likely it would be a more violent place. Another way of understanding this is this. Keep in mind, the idea that somebody would hate themselves, right? So we have to ask the question. And it used to be, particularly, you know, with Kurt Lowen, who created PAR, he also looked at this notion of black self-hatred. First, he looked at the argument of Jewish self-hatred, which was very popular in the 30s and 40s. And then the Jewish scholars began working with black scholars to investigate or examine this thesis of black self-hatred. And the argument was, and it was a progressive argument, I might add, that poor people or marginalized people, excuse me, must hate themselves because the dominant society would argue, given that they don't like the marginalized population, that then the marginalized population then absorbs those ideas from the dominant class and then in turn, right, hates themselves. And that was that idea was made popular by a guy by the name of Charles Cooley, and he created something called the looking glass theory. Right. That logic, that argument actually was used by Thurgood Marshall, Lewis Redding and other folk to win Brown versus Board in 1954. Right. So they're making the argument that our children hate themselves so much. Right. You know, black attorneys are making the argument that our children hate themselves so much that we need to integrate or desegregate the schools so that they can sit next to other children who love themselves and then can model that for black children. That's what won Brown versus Board. Right. So I only bring all of that up to make the larger argument that this self-hating, hopelessness argument, right, has hung in there with us in with regard to Black communities since 1954. And now, while the Black self-hatred thesis is mostly debunked as it relates to most of Black America, right, keep in mind the Black self-hatred thesis, or internalized racism is what we call it now, still around and mostly applied to populations like these men and women in the criminal justice system. And we're here to also debunk the argument. No, they don't hate themselves. They want what we all have. They want to go to school. They want to work, right? They want to go to school, including college. They want to work. They want decent paying jobs. They want their children to go to school. I mean, they want the same things that we want, right? And so the better question is, then what is going on then, right? If you want all of these things, right, and you are aspiring for all of these things, right, then how come it's so difficult to attain them? And in what way can that explain why they are going to the streets to engage in illegal activity, which brings us to a conversation of structural violence.
And structural violence would be things that are imposed by the system defined by the schools, the government, the prison system, the judicial system.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So it's a term, a concept, theory, structural violence theory, is created by a guy by the name of Johann Galtung, Galtung, in 1969. He coins this term or this phrase or this language, and he makes the argument structural violence theory is when structural systems, right, and structural institutions prevent individuals, groups, and neighborhoods from meeting their basic needs. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, right, and I don't mean to disturb anyone's sensibilities, but we do live in a capitalistic society or a capitalistic economy, right? A capitalistic economy, it's not a good or bad argument. I'm just explaining what it is, right? At the end of the day, requires competition. It also requires people to lose or not do well. Or as some social scientists might argue, right, not be resilient. So keep this in mind. If you're not employed, by a lot of resiliency scholars, that's an example of non-resilience. If you're dropping out of school, right, and we know the kids are being pushed out of school, that's evidence for a lot of social scientists, right, social scientists of non-resilience. But those of us who are radically reframing notions of resilience, right, this is what we're saying. People like Ed Gordon from Columbia University, what does he write? Well, he says, well, how can we think about resilience without the intersection of capitalism and resilience? If our schools are requiring people to lose and win, if our society is requiring people to lose and win, that means we will inevitably produce losers. And so when we inevitably produce them, because it's what our society requires or economy requires, then how dare we call them resilient? They were never given a shot to begin with, right? So what does it all really mean, you know, in terms of doing well? And thriving and succeeding, right? And in some respects, it's relative. And it's dependent on access to opportunity, right, in terms of how we understand it all. So with that in mind, the communities, Southbridge, Eastside, neighborhoods, and Wilmington says you cannot be in my community, Yasser Payne, unless you take structural inequality seriously. We don't need, right? This is the kinds of messages that I got. I'll be honest with you. And Victor Perez, he's out there doing good work in Southbridge as well. And I'm sure he's gotten some of these messages. Well, and they're polite. They keep in mind, the messages come to us in polite ways, right? But they're clear, right? And meaning I had to talk about the inequality, the extreme economic poverty. I remember a guy by the name of Richard. His friend got shot and killed his mom. I interviewed his mother for the documentary. And we received permission to actually film for the documentary her son's repast, the funeral, and the viewing. Right, met the young man's friend who died at the repast, and him and his family let me know, if I'm going to be out here in these neighborhoods, and what did he tell me? What did Richard tell me? You better make sure to tell them we don't have food in our refrigerator. You better make sure you tell them about these stories in the hood, quote unquote, if you intend on being out here. Meaning they feel exploited, right? And I would argue we are exploiting them. Keep in mind, low-income Black and brown neighborhoods are a multi-billion-dollar market. Just for the academy alone, for people like me, between the grants, the salaries, the speaking engagements, the books, and I'm a part of the machine, and so keep that in mind. But at the end of the day, we are feeding on them in ways that aren't always beneficial to these communities. So I don't think we fix this overnight, but let's just start talking about it. They are aware of what's going on. They still want us to come inside these communities and do good work, right? But we have to do it with them and not in spite of them.
You mentioned your documentaries a couple of times. You should go ahead and tell people about the two movies, the two documentary movies you've made, so they can find them.
Sure. So the People's Report, which is caught a lot of attention, and the documentary is caught a lot of attention here in Delaware. It really highlights the work in about 60, 65 minutes or so. Keep in mind, you know, we have a large, bulky report, which I do encourage you all to read. But you may or may not be able to get through that. But this becomes a real nice way to understand from beginning to end, right, how we organized the project, how we trained the PAR members, how we collected the data, and also how we placed PAR members and what I would describe as quality employment educational opportunities. Keep in mind, right? So we've highlighted in the documentary how two of our PAR members are now working on their PhDs, right? Another gentleman who's not highlighted in the documentary for doing this, because this just happened, just graduated his bachelor's, and now he's getting ready to work on his Master of Arts in Urban Affairs here at UD.
Cool.
Right? And most of these guys and women are 1 year out of prison, right? And the two guys who completed their master's, right? Oh, yeah. So the two guys who are working on their PhD already completed their master's,
mm-hmm.
right? And we have about three or four other people who have also entered, you know, college as well. Keep in mind, all 15 people received employment opportunities making $15 to $20 an hour during and or after the project funding period ended. The University of Delaware Center for Health and Drug Studies hired all 15 on a particular research project and paid them $17 an hour. So I'm highlighting all of this, and the documentary highlights this as well, because I just want to underscore and reveal what's possible when universities decide to intervene in an appropriate and healthy way, right? So we can help the most marginalized. Given the fact that we have the resources, given the fact that we have the insight, given the fact that we have the networks, right? And that means we can help everyday people if we want to. So we can definitely get a purchase. We can definitely get a copy of the People's Report, or you can definitely get a copy of the People's Report at thepeoplesreport.com. All proceeds go to a research account, every last cent, right, for the next research project, and we're getting ready to get started with that project. And really quickly, I have one other documentary, which is called The Streets of Harlem, How Black Men in the Streets Adapt to Structural Violence. That's the full title. It is not for sale. We're actually going to make that available on YouTube for free. So it's not available just yet, but within the next month, we're just, you know, waiting for the website and everything to kind of come together. We will release it for public consumption.
Time just flies by when we're talking with you, Yasser.
Oh my goodness.
So you want to give me the elevator speech on what you got coming up next?
Really fast. So a part two of the People's Report project, I'm happy to announce. You know, still got to cross a couple of T's and dot a couple of I's, but it looks like this is pretty much going to go through. But we're partnering with Christiana Care Hospital under the leadership of Dr. Leroy Hicks. He's one of the vice chairs there at Christiana Care. We're going to be looking at violence as a public health issue now in the West Side and North Side neighborhoods of Wilmington. These are bigger and larger neighborhoods. These are more violent neighborhoods, I might add, as well. So I do think our experiences in Southbridge and East Side, you know, will and or have prepared us to do work there. So we're hoping to get on the ground late summer, maybe early August at the latest. We have to just do some training first and get our materials together. We're looking to collect about 750 surveys from the street corners out there and really ask some more health-related questions, but also test the thesis that we tested in Wilmington, looking at economic well-being, see to what extent is economic well-being predictive of the violence, and we want to now test that same thesis here in the East Side and West Side, and also we want to look at psychological and social well-being data as well.
Well, clearly, we're going to have you back next year
sure.
to report on your
sure.
experience on the North Side and the West Side.
Absolutely. Looking forward. Definitely.
Yasser Payne, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.